statement on page 363 of Councils on Diet and Foods reads like this. They, that is, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and nuts, they impart a strength, a power of endurance, a vigor of intellect that are not afforded by a more complex and stimulating diet. Now, what were those four food groups again? Fruits, nuts, grains, and vegetables. That's right. These are the four food groups that make the greatest strength, the greatest power of endurance, the greatest vigor of intellect. Now, what biblical character do you know who had the greatest intellect of his day among his colleagues of any of the others? In fact, it was by a factor of 10 times.
Daniel.
That's right. In Daniel 1, when he took his board exams from the king, it was discovered that in the oral part of his board exams that he was 10 times, and the boys with him, the other three students who had been in the University of Babylon for 3 years, it was discovered that these four lads were 10 times smarter than the others who did not eat such a stimulating diet. Would you write it down? And we'll take it. Do want you to write it down. All right. Now notice this one, also on page 363. In grains, fruit, vegetables, and nuts are to be found all the food elements that we need. That means then that our daily requirements can be obtained from what things? Name those again.
Fruits,
nuts,
grains,
and vegetables. These are the big four food groups, aren't they? Now, should we eat anything other than this, it should be taken sparingly. What was that word?
Sparingly.
We should remember that. Is salt fruits, vegetables, whole grains, or nuts? What's the word on how to use salt? What about meat? Is it fruits, vegetables, whole grains, or nuts? If you use it, how should you use it? Sparingly. What about milk? Is it fruits, vegetables, whole grains, or nuts? Depends on what kind. You could have some nut milk, couldn't you? Or some soy milk, and that might be made out of nuts. Well, how would you use milk? Regardless of what kind it is, it should be used sparingly. But certainly if it is dairy milk, I hope that by the end of this class that you will have some information that will help you to know whether you would want to take it at all. If we will come to the Lord in simplicity of mind, He will teach us how to prepare wholesome food. I believe that. I think that I am not really a cook. I'm far more chemist than I am cook. But I believe that the Lord has given me some recipes and some menus of things that go well together. That because I decided that I didn't want to feed my family anything that would be harmful to them, that He has helped me. Okay, I went in simplicity of mind. I certainly did. I didn't have any background in either food chemistry or cooking techniques. But the Lord certainly blessed me with information that I could use to prepare wholesome food, free from anything that I knew would be harmful to my family. Also on this same page, 363, nature's abundant supply of fruits, nuts, and grains is ample. And year by year, the products of all lands are more generally distributed to all by the increased facilities for transportation. Did you know that was in Councils on Diet and Foods? It's on page 363. That was written way back in 1905. Year by year, more available than it had been the year before. Is that, do you suppose, the way that the Lord prepared the way for us to discard all animal products? Why, certainly. That's the way that that is the way that things have been prepared, so that we need not eat any of those things that are harmful to us. Nuts and nut foods are coming largely into use to take the place of flesh meats. With nuts may be combined grains, fruits, and some roots to make foods that are helpful and nourishing. Care should be taken, however, not to use too large a proportion of nuts. What proportion of nuts would you think would be appropriate? 1/6 to 1/10 would be the largest amount. That's of any dish. This on page 364. Much time should be spent in learning how to prepare nut foods. And that would be the meat substitutes. But care should be taken not to reduce the bill of fare to a few articles using little else than the nut foods. What do you suppose that means in terms of today? All right, it says, but care should be taken not to reduce the bill of fare, that means the menu, to a few articles using little else than the nut foods. That means those things that are high in protein, the meat substitutes, should not figure largely in the menu, but that they should be used with restraint. The majority of our people cannot obtain the nut preparations. Few know how to prepare them properly for use, even if they could buy them. Why could they not buy them back in 1905? They were not accessible. That's one reason. And even if they were accessible, what else would prohibit their buying? They didn't have the money. All right, notice this. If they were used more sparingly by some, the results would be more satisfactory. One of the young men who served on one of my touring teams for a long time said that these meats were difficult to digest, these nut meats. In fact, he called them veggie rocks. And maybe that might be a good name for them. Notice that it says if they were used more sparingly by some. Now, some people can use them fine, and if they can, then it's fine to use them. And I'm very thankful for them, especially as flavoring agents. I like to see them used as flavoring agents. If they're going to be used by people who are just coming off meats, it's a great help to have the meat substitutes. But to eat a large slab of some kind of steakette or chocolate, the same size as meat, which should also be taken very sparingly if we were going to take it at all, is really not good nutrition. As combined in large proportions with other articles in some of the recipes given, they make the foods so rich that the system cannot properly assimilate it. Some nuts are not as wholesome as others. Almonds are preferable to peanuts. But peanuts in limited quantities may be used in connection with grains to make nourishing and digestible food. What do you think then about peanut butter? If peanuts should not be largely used but could be used in limited quantities, what would you think of peanut butter? Use it sparingly. Roughly twice the quantity of nuts are required to make peanut butter as nuts. So if you're going to make a cup of peanut butter, you will require 2 cups of peanuts to make it. Same thing with almond butter. If you want to make a cup of almond butter, you will require 2 cups of almonds to make it. Here is something that I think you should know. Those who live in new countries or in poverty-stricken districts where fruits and nuts are scarce should not be urged to exclude milk and eggs from their dietary. Now, that was written also in 1905. Well, here in Alabama, we live in a poverty-stricken area. But we can, even though this is one of the poorer sections of the country, right here in this part, there is no scarcity of fruits or nuts. And we can go into a store and buy anything in Seal, Alabama, or in nearby Phoenix City and Columbus that can be purchased anywhere in the world, because huge trucks are connected to us by interstate with every other part of the world. So there's no difficulty in our day in getting anything that the heart could desire. Back in 1905, it would have been difficult to get some of the things that are so readily accessible today. And besides that, it was not always customary to use the things that we now use in large quantities. Take fruits. There was a time in the South when people didn't use fruits very much except for a between-meal snack, and that only two or three times a year. Father might bring things home at Thanksgiving and at Christmas. And apart from that, we had wild berries and wild fruit, and you would snack on those between meals, but you would go out and pick a little handful of this or that and eat it just a little. But so far as making it a major part of the diet, we wouldn't do that at all. But those who are in new countries where they cannot get fruits and nuts, then they should not be urged to leave off milk and eggs. But I'm wondering if that even applies at all in our day. Because even in new countries, the cheapest food and the most readily available food in our day is fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and nuts. Certainly not milk and eggs and meat, which people would have more of because they could always have some chickens that would forage around, and they could produce some eggs and some milk cows that would graze around, and in that way they could get milk and eggs, and they might not be able to get fruits and vegetables 12 months out of the year. But notice this, persons in full flesh, who is that? Yes, those who are plump, persons in full flesh and in whom the animal passions are strong. Who would that be? Yes, meat eaters, but in particular, what kind of personality do these have who in the animal passions? What is that? Hot temper, oversexed, gloomy, any strong emotion that these individuals might have, they need to avoid the use of stimulating foods, especially in families of children who are given to sensual habits. What would that be? Masturbation and things of that nature. And little boys being girl crazy and little girls being boy crazy. In those families, those who are given to sensual habits, eggs should not be used. Why eggs? Yes, they do. They stimulate the passions. They stimulate the animal passions because of the hormones that they contain, and also because of the balance of nutrients that they contain. The diet reform should be progressive. As disease in animals increases, the use of milk and eggs will become more and more unsafe. Now, that was written in 1905 also. And I believe, from the standpoint of a pathologist, that I have never lived in an age when the use of animal products was really safe. Certainly not in our day. Yesterday, the Journal Constitution, carried a large article on the front page. Did you read that? On eggs. Told that salmonellosis, 80% of the outbreaks of salmonellosis, traceable now to grade A eggs. Now, if you're going to eat eggs, boil them an hour or two and clean up. That might be a little bit of an exaggeration. And clean up your table and treat them as contaminated material. When they come, put them in a plastic bag. And then wash your hands and put that bag in another plastic bag before you put it in your refrigerator, so that you'll be sure and not contaminate anything. And then in any place where you crack it, any bit of the material that comes from it, you see the ovaries of the chickens become, of the hens become infected with the salmonella germs, and then the germs are inside the egg. Well, that's for salmonella. What about for some other things? Well, other things as well come through the eggs. Notice this. As disease in animals increases, the use of milk and eggs will become more and more unsafe. An effort should be made to supply their place with other things that are helpful and inexpensive. People everywhere. Now, notice this sentence. The people everywhere should be taught how to cook without milk and eggs so far as possible and yet have their food wholesome and palatable. Since I first read that statement, I have tried to go everywhere, wherever I can, and teach the people, anybody who will listen, I try to teach them how to cook without using milk and eggs. I have never cracked an egg since I first read that statement, nor poured out a cup of milk in any food demonstration that I have done, nor participated in, because I take that very, very soberly to myself as being responsible to help prepare the people everywhere how to cook without using milk or butter or eggs and things of that nature. On page 366, it says, tell the people that the time will soon come when there will be no safety in using eggs, milk, cream, or butter. That was back in 1902 when that was written. Time would soon come. Here is another. You should be teaching your children. You should be instructing them how to shun the vices and corruptions of this age. Instead of this, many are studying how to get something good to eat and how to stimulate the appetite with ever more stimulating and enticing dishes is the great burden of the life of many cooks, many parents, many mothers have that as the great burden of life. You place upon your tables butter, eggs, and meat, and your children partake of them. And they are fed with the very things that will excite their animal passions. And then you come to meeting and ask God to bless and save your children. How high do your prayers go? You have to have a work to do first. When you have done all for your children which God has left for you to do, then you can with confidence claim the special help that God has promised to give you. So, much to be learned, and we could come into line a lot better if we would do the very things that we had read over 100 years ago. This information became available to us. After 1865, we have had this information available to us. But this is a modern day clipping. Let me just read this. Heavy milk drinking may cause juvenile crime. Did you know that? Well, there have been several leading men, Dr. Alexander Schaus, Dr. Schoenthaler, Dr. Barbara Reed, and a number of other modern psychologists publishing in the medical literature of today, such prestigious journals, psychology journals as Psychology Today, have been publishing information about the use of milk by juvenile delinquents as compared to those who are not juvenile delinquents living in the same socioeconomic and geographic areas. In fact, they have found that milk drinking, in one study that they did, juvenile offenders were found to be consuming 64 ounces of milk and dairy products daily. In the same area, young boys, not juvenile offenders, were found to be using only 30 ounces in the same area. Among girls, juvenile offenders were found to be taking 43 plus ounces of milk and dairy products a day, and non-offenders were found to be taking only 17 ounces per day. So we find that we could have had the benefits of this practice over 100 years ago, But even now with the research, a lot of people say, well, it's too much trouble to go to the trouble of finding out how to make changes, how to get recipes and the like, because we're just looking at different ways to find, quote, something good to eat. Now, here is something on milk. This is written in the, published in the American Journal of Veterinary Research. This is a part of the veterinary literature. This came out in February of last year, 1987. And the title goes like this: Relationships of Bovine Leukemia Virus Prevalence in Dairy Herds and Density of Dairy Cattle to Human Lymphocytic Leukemia. Now, let me just translate that in terms that you can readily get a handle on. It is just saying that as leukemia in cattle goes up, and there is an increase in the number of dairy cows in an area, the incidence of lymphocytic leukemia goes up in the children and in the and in older people in that population. And so we find in the United States, those states that have the highest population of dairy cows, they also have the highest incidence of lymphocytic leukemia. And there are published reports that show that there is a good possibility that the bovine leukemia virus, that's the cow leukemia virus, is exactly the same virus causing leukemia in humans. And so we can see that cancer is related, cancer in animals is related, can be related to cancer in humans. In one study that was done, they took 20 leukemic cows, that is cows that had developed leukemia on their own. They had not been experimentally caused to have leukemia. They took at the same time 20 lambs. So here they were with the 20 leukemic cows, and they numbered them 1 through 20, and they had the 20 young lambs, a different species of animal altogether. They matched cow number 1 with lamb number 1, and cow number 2 with lamb number 2. And at the end of the test period, they found that 17 of the 20 lambs had what kind of leukemia? Bovine, not lamb leukemia, but bovine leukemia virus. And they had leukemia with the bovine leukemia virus. So we find that leukemia virus from cattle does cross species lines. I find that to be incriminating. And so to me, milk is a dangerous fluid. I don't even like to touch it. I find that in my way of thinking that milk and eggs are more unclean now, more unsafe for food than pork was back in the days of Christ. So I just don't have much stomach for dairy products. Now here is one on listeriosis. Listeria monocytogenes is a germ that has recently begun to cause a good bit of problem. It has a very high mortality rate. People who get the listeriosis have a very high mortality rate, 40 or more percent mortality rate in those who get the listeriosis in recent studies that have been done. This comes from the FDA drug bulletin for October of last year, 1987, the Food and Drug Administration drug bulletin. So if you get this FDA drug bulletin, you'll find it on page 28 for October of last year, 1987. It goes on to say that it starts, the title is Research on Listeria Monocytogenes. And this is a report that comes from the Centers for Disease Control. This is the most widely known, widely publicized, widely accepted scientific organization for disease control in the world today. And according to the study published by the CDC, Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, they reported that people contract this disease from milk and cheese and ice cream and other dairy products. Well, much more could be said about that, but let's go on to some other things. I'm just touching, just giving you a small aliquot of the scientific information of our day. It is voluminous in the little book that my husband and I wrote called The Animal Connection between the human disease and animal disease. We have more than one reference per page to the current medical literature. Now, I would like to show you some transparencies. And that's going to be in your way. So let me just put this right here. And I'll just get... I think I can reach it right there, Mary. Thank you. And let's start, since we're doing some study on Judaism, let's take a little study on, this came from the Jewish Encyclopedia, Dietary Laws, Funk and Wagnall. This is the big authoritative encyclopedia, has many, many volumes to it. And even the one on diet had more than one volume. Huge, thick books like this. I found this in an obscure library. Well, it's not so very obscure, but it was set back from the street in London. And I was very happy to have the opportunity to read this. I'd never seen the Jewish Encyclopedia in this country. Now, here are some things that I found out about the diet of the ancient Jewish people. It was principally vegetarian, except at great festivals and circumcisions and weddings. Dairy products were not abundant, often given as gifts, especially cream and cheese made from sweet milk by a kitchen process. Blood was drained at slaughter, fat was removed, and even after that, the meat was boiled and the first water thrown away and then reboiled again. Fish was uncommon except around large bodies of water. It was eaten broiled, sun-dried, salt-cured, or prepared in milk. Grains were the principal staple: wheat, barley, millet, and spelt. Lentils and other beans were used, cucumbers, melons, immature carob, greens, fruits, onion family, herbs, and nuts. And at the same time that the ancient Jews lived, the Babylonians, Hindus, Egyptians, and others also avoided unclean meats for spiritual reasons. Breastfeeding was often carried into the fourth year of the life of the individual. Now, in our day, let's just take a look at unclean animals. They store toxins in their flesh. I'm sure you remember about the PCBs and that big problem that came to us. You probably also remember in the newspapers about the mercury poisoning that the man had in his family because of the mercury stored in the body of the hogs that had eaten. They will eat most anything. They have loathsome habits. That's all unclean animals. They have excretory systems that by design hold back wastes. It is impossible to avoid eating the blood, entrails, and wastes of many of these unclean animals, like shrimp. The animals are exposed to decaying matter, mycotoxins. That's those toxins that are produced by fungi, and environmental chemicals. They eat more poisonous plants. They will accept more poisonous plants than will any other animal ordinarily used for food. They are subject to more diseases than clean animals, and they receive more drugs. And a list of these diseases include parasites, erysipelas, sores, coccidiosis, jaundice, tuberculosis, infectious cough, swine fever, diarrhea, pneumonia, paratyphoid, and cancer. This came from the London Times, October 29, 1985. And during the time that this study was reported, some of the men who were butchering animals were fined because of their illegal use of drugs for the animals. Now, pigs are the most prolific food animal, requires little space. They can weigh over 800 pounds. They suffer from many diseases, and they are adversely affected by the environment. Fatigue depletes their glycogen, increases the pH, and encourages bacterial growth in the meat. So when you get it, it's more likely to have bacteria growing in it. The excitement of the animal, and this would include any animal used for food, excitement at slaughter causes inefficient bleeding and retention of blood, wastes, hormones, and germ growth. The animals are often starved 24 hours before slaughter to reduce intestinal bacteria and postmortem blood infection or burst intestine and contamination. But many of the animals are not starved, and then you have all these problems. Have the intestinal bacteria, the postmortem blood infection, burst intestine and contamination, and so forth. If gutting is delayed, gases and germs pass to the flesh. Even in most efficient butcheries, carcass infection is common. In fact, almost universal. Animals are transported at night as temperatures are lower then. And often, in very cold climates, their transportation at night results in their freezing to death. When I was working in Birmingham year before last, there was a chicken packing factory just behind our house. And often in the morning as we were going into our field work, we would see these large trucks of chickens coming by in the very cold morning. I remember one morning Ann and I were huddled by the heater just hoping that it would get hot very quickly. We had on muffs and caps and long johns and boots and mittens and muffs and everything that we could, trying to keep warm. And we were inside a closed car with a heater going. And we passed a large truck with chickens on an open truck with open crates, and their heads were hanging out. The chickens had already frozen to death on that cold morning. But you can be sure that those that were dead already weren't thrown away, that they went right on to the butchery, and these dead animals were butchered and sold in the markets, and people ate them and enjoyed eating the flesh of these animals that had been frozen to death in a sub-zero temperature. The London Times in April the 11th, 1986, reported large swine fever outbreak. Thousands of pigs had to be destroyed. Also frequent are cancers, catarrh, and salmonella. That's in pigs also. I don't have much use for pigs as food. In fact, I consider pork to be inedible. That's the word. And as a physician, I tell people don't eat it. It's a dangerous food. Now, what about trichinosis? Haven't we conquered that? Indeed not. Trichinosis is still around. In fact, it may be as bad as ever, if not worse. Here are mussels with the little trichina worms in them. These are mussel cells, and once these little worms get encysted in the mussel, they're there until the animal dies. Now, if the animal is slaughtered and a human being eats the flesh, then these trichina organisms are, their shell is digested by the digestive juices, and the little worm is liberated and gets out into your bloodstream and goes to your muscles and there takes up residence. And from then on, as long as you live, there they are, set up residence in your muscles. Now, does this cause you any problem? The answer is yes. It does cause you some problem. Here is what happens. Immediately, if you have a very heavy infestation of the trichina worms, you will have something like a fever and joint aches and muscle pains and you will not feel very good. Then all through the rest of your life, you will be throwing off little bits of toxin, or these worms will be throwing off little bits of toxin, which get into your bloodstream and cause you to have an uncomfortable feeling. And so the quality of your life is just not quite up to par. Now, isn't it a rare thing, you might ask, that a person would get trichinosis in our day? And the answer is no, not at all. In fact, in some studies, 7 out of 10 people who use pork do have antibodies to the trichina in their bloodstreams. That means that they have living in their own flesh trichina organisms. Right now, trichina worms are living right there in their own flesh and causing them to produce antibodies at that time. So you can see we're dealing with something that is indeed a problem. Now let's just study where you would get protein from if you don't get it from the meat source. If one takes animal protein, then one can get a certain quantity of animal protein or protein in the diet. Notice that men in non-vegetarian cuisines will get 125 grams of protein per day, and women will get 94. Among the ovo-lacto vegetarians, men get 98 grams of protein per day, and women get 82 grams. Now, if you're a total vegetarian, that is, you use no meat, milk, eggs, or cheese, men on such a diet will get about 83 grams of protein daily, and women will get about 61 grams of protein per day. Is that adequate? Well, according to Dr. Hegstead, all we need, Dr. Hegstead is one of the acclaimed authorities in nutrition for our day. I think he's from Harvard or Yale. Where is he from, Dr. Calvin?
MIT.
And he says that we don't need but just 8 grams of well-selected protein per day. Well, 8 grams is about the amount that would balance on your 8 fingernails. So that's not very much food, is it, to give you those 8 grams of protein per day. And so I don't feel that we need to do too much worrying about getting adequate quantities of protein from a totally vegetarian diet, if even women will be getting more than 60 grams per day, even though they eat a little less than men do. Now, here from the Journal of the American Medical Association for September the 11th, 1987, is a little excerpt from the current medical literature, The Dietary Composition and Renal Function in Healthy Subjects. And it goes on to say that in healthy people who take a diet high in protein, they tend to have poorer renal function than do others. And notice this sentence, the vegan diet. What is the vegan diet? No meat, milk, eggs, or cheese. No animal protein of any kind. The vegan diet is associated with glomerular and systemic hemodynamic changes that may be beneficial in the prevention of glomerular sclerotic changes in health and disease. Now, translated into words that you will easily be able to hear, that simply means that if you eat a diet that contains no animal products, that there are certain things that occur in your arteries and heart and blood that make it so that you're very likely not to get the sclerotic changes. That's the scarring and the narrowing of small blood vessels that those get who use a mixed diet. So from almost any standpoint that you study it, the vegan diet or the totally vegetarian diet has superior aspects to it than that of a non-vegan diet. Now, proteins, as you know, are made up of amino acids. The average American is taking about 46% of his calories in the form of carbohydrate, 12% is protein, and 42% is fat. Is that ideal?
No.
We studied yesterday about carbohydrates, and what did we find was more ideal for human beings? 70% was more toward being ideal, and that some, like Pritikin, you know, Pritikin taught that the 10-10-80 diet was ideal for humans. And he may be right. Certainly we're moving more in nutrition in that direction all the time, to the 10-10-80 type of diet, so that we can see that this is the kind of direction that we go in. And the 12% protein is too high in protein, and of course 42% fat, that's just a ridiculously high in fat. Now let's just take these studies on endurance, and this will be the last study for this afternoon's class. Fat and protein diet, if the person takes mainly meat, milk, eggs, and cheese, that makes up a large proportion of his diet, as we just mentioned, such an individual will have 0.6 grams per 100 of muscle fuel. Now, if we put him at maximum work, we give him a heavy load and put him at maximum work going uphill on a treadmill, he will be able to maintain that for 60 minutes. Now, a person who has the same level of athletic training, but who is on a mixed diet, he will be getting 1.8 grams of muscle fuel per 100 grams. His maximum work time is 120 minutes instead of the 60 minutes of the person on a high meat, high animal product diet. This person eats some meat and some cheese, but eats also vegetables and fruits. And so he can endure for 120 minutes. But let's take the person who is on a vegan diet. This is high in carbohydrates, and the muscle fuel is 3.5 grams per cent. And the maximum work time for the same individual is 180 minutes. And so when big, strong men tell me that they have to have good red meat in order to have strength and endurance, I just have to sort of chuckle up my sleeve a little bit at these individuals. I know that they are just fooling themselves. They just want to eat what pleases them, and so they have decided that they cannot do their heavy work on the kind of diet that I teach as being most helpful.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you would discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. American Christian Ministries is not a one-man band. It is an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.